You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
And for Dear Science, we are joined once again by our expert, Dr. Christian McGovern. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
And we've got lots of exciting stories on here for science today. Starting off with these, straight out of a spy movie, as I said earlier, night vision contact lenses.
Yeah, so I saw the term supervision and had to look a little bit further. So this is group, they've basically made these contact lenses that mean you can perceive near infrared light. So this is light beyond what we can perceive. It's 800 to sort of 1600 nanometers. And why this is quite cool is because obviously they're contact lenses, so they don't require a power source and they're transparent, so you can still see.
Mm.
So how they did this? So their first experiment was not one that I find appealing, in that they have these nanoparticles, and this is what converts the infrared light to visible light. So then, so we can perceive the visible light. So the first time they did this experiment is they injected these nanoparticles into mice retina.
Ooh.
And then did some experiments and like, yes, the mice perceive the infrared light. So no one wants to get injections into your eyes.
No.
So they made some contact lenses. And all this required was getting the polymers that you use to make your contact lenses, mixing in some nanoparticles, and then putting them into mouse eyes, which I really wish there was kind of video
some
of that.
Some tiny contact lenses, yeah, that'd be nice.
And the way that you could test that the mice actually perceived the infrared light was you'd have two boxes. One would have infrared light flickering in it, one would be completely dark. And so the mice with contact lenses would go to the box that was just dark. They didn't want to go where it was flickering. Whereas the mice that had no contact lenses, didn't matter. They went to one or the other because they couldn't perceive the infrared light.
Yeah.
They also examined their pupils and did some brain imaging. And so they were like, okay, it seems like these mice are actually perceiving this infrared light. Let's put them in humans.
Mm.
And they did. And this is, yeah, basically if the infrared light was flickering, people could see it was flickering. They could perceive which direction it was coming from. And if you close your eyelids, you actually perceived the infrared light much better, because you now weren't getting the visual cue as well, right? The infrared light can pass through your eyelids, but the visual can't. So you can perceive infrared light and you can color code it. So depending on the wavelength of this infrared light, you can make it appear blue or green or red.
Oh.
So they did actually go and make some glasses as well, if you're not really comfortable with putting things in your eyes, which I definitely am not. So I was quite happy to see there's some glasses you could use. There are always caveats, right? So at the moment, it's only if someone's got like an LED torch that's flickering has the infrared light. They're not sensitive enough yet for just kind of low-level light. So they're obviously going to work to make these a lot more sensitive. And, maybe you'll see them in what were their applications they kind of mentioned were obviously security, rescue, encryption and anti-counterfeiting and stuff. So
yeah, fun stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, and maybe in the future you could buy these anywhere, right?
You know, and you can communicate with your friends
fun
without everyone else knowing.
Glasses, yeah.
Morse code might come back.
And then this next story about giant sloths. I mean, I don't even know where to start. How does a sloth get this big?
Right. So, yeah. So we all think of sloths. We think of these really slow-moving things that live in trees. You know, people get them, like, they look reasonably cute if you don't look at their claws. And so people get them on their socks and their bags and all this sort of thing. Well, we only have two species of sloths now. They live in Central and South America. But this was not always the case. So there used to be lots of different species of sloth. And some of them were really, really big. So the biggest sloth, which died about 12,000 years ago, belonged to a genus called Megathermium, and it was basically the size of an Asian bull elephant. So that meant it was about 3,600 kilos.
Wow.
So you can go on Wiki and you can see these pictures of, like, they've got quite complete skeletons of this thing. It's massive. So how did something that we now only know of as living in trees...
Yeah, how did it even get up there?
Well, they didn't live in trees, right. These ones, right? So if you think about what this study wanted to do was better understand why there were these massive giant sloths, right, when we associate them with being in trees. So they did the thing that these studies often do is they went to a bunch of museums and universities, institutes around the world that had fossils and measured them. Also, because these aren't so old, you can actually do ancient DNA studies on them.
Mm. Wow. So is that like, I'm not a science person, but is that like carbon dating kind of?
No, it's actually that you can actually, from these fossil bones, because they're not super old, the DNA actually hasn't degraded in them. And so people now have methods for extraction. And so you can actually sequence DNA.
Oh, cool.
It's not easy, but you can do it. Mm. And so they can then start to do comparisons between different species of bones that they've, you know, they've looked at the bones, they've decided that it's a different species, and then you get the DNA and you can start to do these analyses that are a lot more complex than just if you look at bones and measure them. And so what they found, first thing, not so surprising, that the tree sloths, or the soft sloths that live in trees, that's really hard to say, tended to be small.
Yeah.
And the ones that lived on the ground
tended to be bigger.
Tended to be big.
Yeah.
Maybe not too surprising why. Turns out I learned that sloths that we have now are actually really good at surviving falls out of trees. They can fall 30 metres and kind of just bounce back. You know, they don't
They don't really look like they have... Like, they look kind of malleable, almost.
Yeah, so
I can't think of a better word for it, but they look like they absorb the pressure really well.
Yeah, and it turned out they do, because, you know, like, they avoid falling, but, of course, they're slow moving, so they're not going to always avoid it. whereas, as you can imagine, if you're on the ground, being big is advantageous, right? Yep. But why? Like, why did these massive sloths... evolve? And so what they did was they basically put together all this information that they'd gathered about these measurements, this DNA, what they know about climate and how it changed over the time where these things were living, and did what's called a phylogenetic analysis. So it's basically looking at how an animal evolved from its ancestors and such. Mm-hmm. So the oldest thing that can be considered a sloth is called Pseudoglyptodon, and it lived 37 million years ago. And it was a It actually lived on the ground, and it was about the size of a Great Dane.
So reasonably big,
we're right?
But a bit closer to the sloths we know now.
Exactly, right? And then the size of them didn't really change for about 20 million years. They did go into the trees a bit, but they didn't really get... The size didn't change majorly. They didn't become the massive sloth. Then what happens in North America, between what's now Washington State and Idaho... The way this was described was basically a giant wound opened up into the earth and magma boiled out.
Wow.
So it was a volcanic event, right? And it lasted about 750,000 years. So volcanic event, it releases a lot of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. And this changes the climate, right? And so it's actually considered the likeliest cause of what's called the mid-Miocene climatic optimum warming. So the planet got a bit warmer.
Just rolls off the tongue.
It does, doesn't it? You got to love these terms for time. And so what happened with this warmer temperature is actually sloths became a bit smaller.
Hmm.
So we're going the other way than what we were initially interested.
Seems like we're losing progress. Well, yeah.
Exactly. And but what happens with these warmer temperatures is you get more rain, so you probably got more forests, there was more trees to live in, so they started inhabiting the trees. For about a million years after that volcano went silent, the planet was still pretty warm. And then it started cooling again. And so it started to cool. The sloths kind of took to the ground again a bit more. When you're on the ground, you can actually go a lot more places. You're not confined to the trees kind of thing. So they've been found in the fossils been found in the Andes Mountains. They went through the deciduous forests of North America up into the boreal forests of Canada and Alaska. And so you've got all these different environments. So you travel, like the various species are traveling and stuff. So you might get bigger because you can travel more efficiently. You can conserve water and energy, right? Especially if you're in areas where there's maybe not a lot of resource, there's not a lot of food.
Yeah.
So being a bit bigger tends to help. If you're out in an open savanna, grassland sort of thing, being big's good protection, right? you don't want to take them.
I'm now imagining a massive sloth wandering around the savannah, and it is awesome.
Exactly, yeah. Right? What makes them even cooler is they have the largest claws of any known mammal alive now or in the extinct.
Wow.
Right? If you look at these fossils, they've got these claws that are massive. And they liked living in caves, so they could actually, like, they found claw marks in the caves from these things. But what happened, about 15,000 years ago, all these sloth species started disappearing. Won't blame anyone, but it does coincide with humans getting into North America.
Right.
And there have been some fossils found with kind of hunting marks or bones found with. And you had, other than the two species we have now, the final two species that were hanging out before then were actually in the Caribbean till about 4,500 years ago. And again, not blaming anyone, but that's when humans kind of turned up on the scene. So, yeah. But giant sloth, very, very cool.
Yeah, wow. And then this last bit, breaking down biofilms, this is some handy knowledge for anyone who's a bit scared of germs in their kitchen
or
anywhere else,
so,
really.
Probably not a method you're going to apply in your kitchen just yet, but good to know they're making progress. So just biofilm, if you think, if you haven't really been doing your cleaning and you get that pink sort of slimy film going around your shower and stuff, it's biofilm. Biofilms, you find them in bathrooms, food factories. Well, we try not to have them, we try and get rid of them. They're a big problem in health, they can be cause infections and such. And basically what it is if it's a bacterial biofilm, you have some bacterial cells that kind of clump together and then they excrete some substances around themselves that kind of acts as a protective shell kind of thing. Mm. Like they get harder to kill because it's called extra polymeric substance, so it's just the stuff around the cells, and it makes them more resistant to antimicrobials. So if you have to up the antibiotic dosage, you have to give it more disinfectant to try and get rid of it. And so we're obviously always trying to look for ways to better kill these things and get rid of them. And so what this study did was they used a type of bacteria called Pseudomonas aeruginosa, which is a serious problem in health, and they grew some biofilm. And they chemically treated it. So they had a biofilm they did nothing to, one they put hydrogen peroxide on, and one that they put hydrogen peroxide and peroxyacetic acid. And they kind of killed about 50% of it. But the next day it had grown up again and it was still there. So what they were really interested in was this idea of, what if we bust up that extra polymeric substance? So what if we bust up that matrix so that those cells that are in the center aren't so protected?
Yeah.
And so what they used was, they gave it a really fancy name, self-locomotive antibacterial microbubblers.
Mm.
So they basically made these things that when you added hydrogen peroxide to them, they released little oxygen bubbles. And so that acted as mechanical disruption to your biofilm.
Doing a bit of dividing and conquering.
Exactly. That is exactly it. And so what they did was they applied those and it would disrupt about or get rid of about 95% of the biofilm, come in with the chemical afterwards, get rid of the last 5%, and then, the next day it didn't regrow and it didn't regrow for ages. And so it's this whole thing of, you might, it's elbow grease as well as disinfectant.
Big changes in the world of biofilm, hopefully getting rid of it for the places where we don't need it to be, right?
Exactly, yeah.
It seems to be where it's always cropping up.
I've never actually seen it before, so I guess that's a good sign. It's not
your house. Yeah, you're doing your cleaning.
All right, well, thank you for sharing these science stories with us, as always. And we might be able to see, as you mentioned, with this biofilm and the night vision lenses as well, we might be able to see these cropping up in future, as always is the case with science. But yeah, thank you for coming in today, Kushla. Thank you, Motet. And thank you, science. We'll be right back after this short break. Keep it on the B.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to Motet, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.